I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. We don't often have the opportunity to see a snowy owl, but this year there seem to be plenty of them around. Today it is bird news with ornithologist Vernon Lux. Vern joins us from our studio at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. Morning, Vern.
Good morning, Mindy.
So this is called what, a snowy owl incursion?
Actually, they call it an eruption.
An eruption.
Like not an eruption like a volcanic one, but an eruption. But it's an incursion. It's what we're seeing is unprecedented, really. Since we've been keeping records and people have been birding in New England and beyond, it's just a staggering number of snowy owls that have appeared.
And why is that?
Well, there's lots of speculation and theories, and we always assumed that it was because, anyway, there's a bunch of new research out. And snowy owls breed basically around the top of the planet, above the Arctic Circle on the tundra. And anyone that's been up there in the summer knows that it's called the land of the midnight sun. The sun stays up all day long and just goes around in a circle, so it's never dark. So snowy owls have to be able to hunt and do everything in the daytime. They're diurnal, mm-hmm. which is why we see so many more of them. It was always assumed that they just came south when there was a crash in the lemmings. These small furry rodents look like our meadow voles, mm-hmm. and they go. They're very cyclic in their populations. Anyway, it turns out over the ensuing years, now they've got transmitters on snowy owls. They found out all kinds of fascinating things about them. And this year, with this incredible incursion southward of this eruption, a gentleman up in Newfoundland named Bruce McTavish, on the weekend of December 7th and 8th on the Avalon Peninsula, which is where St. John, Newfoundland is, he saw 304 snowy owls.
Wow.
This is like, no, you know, that's 100 times more than anyone had ever seen in a location before. Like, what is going on?
You have to pinch yourself,
Yeah, and they kept coming south. It's unbelievable. In fact, they just had a snowy owl in Florida, in Jacksonville. They've basically, first they invaded the Northeast, the Atlantic provinces, and New England. Logan Airport's had an incredible number of snowy owls. I believe Norman Smith has trapped and banded some 45 owls at this point.
Wow.
He's caught them off the runways to get them because they collide with jets and can cause, nobody wants that.
Yeah.
It would be horrible. It's horrible for the owl, but if it brought down a plane, that would be more horrible probably.
Right.
No,
yeah.
Much more.
Definitely.
So trying to answer your question, I digress all the time. Bruce McTavish does a lot of research around the Arctic. And he was in contact with various people doing work on snowy owls around the Arctic. And because people were assuming, did these birds come from Greenland? Did they come from Baffin Island? Did they come from Alaska? Well, it turns out it was a really lousy year for breeding for snowy owls over most of the Arctic. But the one place that had incredible, a lemming, just like incredible numbers of these rodents was in northern Quebec, which is almost due north from here on the Ungava Peninsula. And the owls actually wander widely in the spring until they find a place that has huge numbers of these rodents. And owls came from all around, and they began nesting. One of the researchers, Bruce, sent a picture out of a snowy owl nest with the eggs in it still, and the nest was surrounded by like some 70 dead lemmings. In other words, it was a cache of dead rodents all the way around this nest. And because it's the Arctic, it's cold, there's no flies, the meat's not going to spoil. So when those young owls hatched, they had a ready supply of meat for weeks almost. But the owls can't help themselves. When they see a rodent, they go out and catch it and bring it back. So Vern,
because they had this a lot of lemmings and they were lining these nests, in other words, all of the babies they survive, right? Where normally they
would
not. Is that why we're seeing so many then?
Yeah, and not only do they survive, but when the female has this many lemmings around, she'll lay more eggs.
Ah.
She can lay up to 10 or 12 eggs.
Oh, my goodness.
So they had great breeding success. All the baby owls fledged. And then, of course, it turns to September and October, and things get cold. The snow comes up, and there isn't enough food there for these owls to survive. Plus, the adult owls that do remain on territory, some of them, get territorial, and they drive off the young birds. So all of a sudden, these these massive number of owls from northern Quebec start heading south. Usually they head south earlier. They start showing up here in October. This year, it just sort of happened. Right around Thanksgiving, huge numbers of owls started to arrive. And so that's what we think is going on.
Will happen to them? Because if they're being driven out by the other adults that are territorial, where will these birds go?
Well, you know, young birds, especially young raptors, hawks and owls, the normal mortality rate for a young bird is 50% of them don't make it through their first year anyway, in a normal year.
Wow.
So if there's some other extreme stuff going on. So of all the owls that have been driving south here, I mean, just for example, on the Nantucket Christmas bird count, which was conducted here on the last Sunday in December, there were 33 snowy owls recorded. Mm. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but if you go back over the 80 years that this count has been conducted, guess what the previous high count was for Nantucket?
I know, it's number four.
It was four. Yeah. You know this. Yeah. That's good. And then there'd only been two a couple of times, and then most years it was zero or one.
Yeah.
So 33.
That's amazing.
The Outer Cape count had record numbers. The Mid-Cape count had record numbers. It's an amazing year for snowy owls. So for any listeners, this is your chance. If you want to see a snowy owl, if you put a little effort into it, this is the time to go see one.
All right. So I know there are people saying, all right, where? How do I find them?
Right. Well, they're not as obvious. If you're not a birder and you don't have a spotting scope, you don't need a spotting scope. Binoculars are fine, but you do need binoculars. And right now, again, the snow has melted. And so they're much easier to see. And when it's snowy out, boy, their camouflage is perfect. There are snowy owls from Provincetown to Sandwich to every town. Falmouth probably has the least number of snowy owls and Dennis. But this past weekend in Provincetown, there were at least four owls. There were one or two seen on the breakwater off McMillan Wharf. There was one at the Race Point parking lot. There were two others seen. One was at High Head. They're pretty much all over. Nauset Beach in Eastham has them. South Beach in Chatham.
So really, you're looking at the beaches because where they come from, there are no trees. So they're looking for the open beach, area.
Correct. The beaches on the Cape and Islands are the best places by far. Right. They love the sand dunes. And what happens here, a lot of these owls are not hunting rodents and rabbits and stuff, although they'll happily eat those. They actually switch their diet. And they're feeding on sea ducks and grebes and things. I watched one actually yesterday go out low over the water off the southeast corner of Nantucket. And it went way up. First, it went up really high. And then it probably flew a half mile to three-quarters of a mile offshore. And then it dropped down right on the deck and was whipping along. And, of course, the birds out there are not prepared for a giant owl coming low level on the water. And if a little bird pops up, they grab it and then they bring it in and eat it. Yeah, it's amazing. Birds.
Well, and I should say, on the vineyard, I know they had been seeing them out at the Farm Institute in South Beach. So those are some good places to look.
Sure, the Katama, the Farm Institute's great. Chappaquiddick's really good going down to Cape Pogue. The best place, if you're in the Mid-Cape area, on the Mid-Cape Christmas bird count, they had eight snowy owls on Sandy Neck and out in the Great Marsh.
Wow.
And over Corporation Beach and Dennis had some. Basically, if you go out really looking and paying attention, you'll find one.
Right. And we should thank the listeners who have sent in some photos of their snowy owls that they've sent to our Bird News website and Facebook. And somebody had one on a roof in Dennis. So that was kind of unusual. And so what's going to happen to the birds as far south, like in Jacksonville? I mean, are they going to be able to survive that far south?
It's a good question. And they actually just started a project. A bunch of people decided with this huge eruption of owls, we don't actually know that much about what happens to them during the winter and on migration. Mm. Norman Smith at Logan, a number of years ago, was able to get some money, and he put satellite transmitters on like a dozen snowy owls.
Yeah, so he did 40, right?
A couple of those snowy owls survived. One flew all the way back to the North Slope of Alaska and bred, and then came back to Logan the next winter.
Oh, wow. So you said he banded about 40 or so. This will be good information because he'll have a bigger number to kind of monitor, right?
Well, that's true, but without the transmitters. So there's a new project. If you go online, anyone, and just Google, so the banding code for a snowy owl is the first two letters of each common name. So for a snowy owl, it's S-N-O-W, snow, mm-hmm. which is really quite great, you know? Like a ruddy turnstone is Rutu. And mm-hmm. so snow, they've started, they're actually doing a fundraising thing. They have these new transmitters now they can attach. They're little solar-powered backpacks, basically, that don't hurt the bird. They don't interfere with breeding. And they can put them on the birds. And this is a new technology. It actually downloads, whenever it gets near a cell tower, it'll download all the information up to something like 5,000 entries. So, because, of course, when the snowy owls go north, they're not going to be encountering any cell towers.
Yeah.
But if it flew back in the fall, all of a sudden when it hit its first cell tower, all this data would download. So they're already getting you can track a couple of snowy owls that are down in Delaware and New Jersey right now that have these backpacks. Mm. And it's fascinating what they're going to learn.
All right, so as we mentioned photos, Nan from Brewster said, our family loves bird news. Enclosed is a snowy owl we were fortunate to see and take pictures of in Brewster on Christmas. And Jenny says it's a really great photo she's putting up on our website and our Facebook page. And we have, again, some more owl pictures that we'll put up that our listeners have sent in. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. If you've been seeing a snowy owl maybe this morning, yesterday, let us know where, because I know there are a lot of folks who'd like to go see them. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Vern, you mentioned the Christmas bird counts and the snowy owls.
Just to interrupt for one second, Mindy, and to anyone that does go look for the owls, these owls are, I just want a word of caution, and not to get too close to the owls. Don't flush the owls. Yep. You can tell if you're looking, in other words, I have actually had three dead snowy owls brought into me already this winter, because a lot of they're young birds and some of them are starving. Some of them, it looks like, might have run into something. But the birds don't, they're here for a reason. They're trying to get food. And if people are out looking for them and are overly enthusiastic, trying to get closer to get mm-hmm. pictures and stuff, I would encourage you to observe them from a distance. Don't let your dogs go flush them. Be responsible. It's great to see the owl, but we don't want to stress the owl out.
Right,
Right. Which
is why you said you need binoculars. It's a really good point. Yeah. And if you flush them, they may fly away and then you won't see them again.
I saw some people. I won't go into it, but just be respectful of the birds.
Good point. I'm glad you mentioned that. All right. So what else did we see on the Christmas bird counts?
The Christmas bird counts this year were actually rather dull.
Uh-oh.
The weather wasn't great. It got cold. It got really colder here earlier than it has been for the past decade almost. So a lot of birds that are sort of semi-hardy, warblers and things that linger, when we get heavy snow cover or storm like last Friday, things like that tend to become deceased, sadly. The Outer Cape count, I think, was very uneventful. The most notable thing was they had a record count of snowy owls, their highest in 80 years of running that count, or 86 years. There was almost a total lack of alcids. Hmm. The black and white seabirds, puffins, well, we don't get many puffins, but usually razorbills.
Dovekies.
Murres, dovekies are the little tiny ones, right? And, I mean, there were six razorbills on the Outer Cape count, and normally there would be thousands. Hmm. So that was very weird, although this past weekend, Blair Nicula was up in P-Town sea-watching, and all of a sudden the razorbills appeared. He had something like 15,000 pass by.
They were just a little late.
for whatever reason, the lack of food or water temperature or wherever they went, they just didn't come in a normal time frame. Mm-hmm. The Buzzards Bay count was pretty average this year. I guess they had a couple of interesting things. The Mid-Cape count, which was done the Friday after Christmas, is going to be, they had 139 species, which is fabulous, especially for this year. I can't remember, they didn't have anything really earth-shaking, but they had lots of birds, and that's going to be the highest count in all of New England, including Connecticut this year. So the Mid-Cape bird count was the best one in the region, which is pretty cool. Nantucket ended up at 125 species, but a couple of shorebirds that had never been seen here before, called long-billed dowitchers, were recorded. Of course, the weather was terrible count day, and it rained. It was overcast, and it rained all afternoon. The next day, a couple of gentlemen from Connecticut found a gull called a mew gull, which is a small... The mew gulls are common on the West Coast. That's called a mew gull. And then they're in Europe, and there's some in Siberia. There's three different races. And the bird that they found appears to be the race from Siberia called a Kamchatka gull. Some authorities split this off as a separate species. Some people consider it a subspecies. At any rate, it's a really great bird. They got some pictures, and it looks, from all the photos, it looks like a Kamchatka gull, which may in fact be like a new bird for the region. So that was pretty exciting.
Yeah. And was there some unusual warbler somewhere that somebody saw?
Yes, there's a warbler coming to it. It wasn't on the bird counts, but someone right there, I think in your studio, at their bird feeder.
Oh, it was Elsa. Okay.
Right, they had a warbler show up at their feeder.
That's right.
And got some great pictures of it, and they have an orange-crowned warbler at their feeder, which is really a very, very good bird.
Is it still there, Elsa? No, it's gone. Darn, I was going to say we're all heading over to Elsa's house.
Well, we don't want to put it out, because seriously, bird watchers would come from around the state to see it.
It's gone. It's gone. It's all gone.
That's good. It's gone. There never was an orange-crowned warbler.
All right, John is giving us a call from Woods Hole. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mandy. How are you?
Good.
Good. Good morning.
I am fascinated with your owl program here, and in November, I was out on a cruise on the Nore. We were about 100 miles south of Martha's Vineyard, getting ready to deploy some moorings for the OOI program, and a snowy owl flew up and landed right on the mooring, and I was wondering if you'd heard of any owls being that far out to sea.
John, did you send a photo?
I did.
Yeah, I was going to say, okay, because we got that photo. Vern, you saw that.
I do. Yeah, it was posted on, it was also on the HUI website there, I believe.
Yep.
Yeah. That was cool.
Then you did get it. I wasn't sure you got that photo from a while back.
Yeah, I think you were aware.
I actually was out of the country at the time, but when I got home, I saw the photo. That was one of the first ones seen, yeah. Yeah, not only have there been other owls out to sea landing on boats, but two snowy owls have made it all the way to Bermuda this winter. Which is, how far Bermuda is, what, 800, 1,000 miles south, and I don't know, how 600 miles out to sea or something? Maybe is John still there?
Yeah, he's still there.
He could answer where Bermuda is better than I can. And that's...
Interesting. Okay, I'll take the rest of the comments off there, but John, that's great. I hadn't ever heard of them being out there, and I wasn't sure that you had.
Yeah, John, before you go, how shocked were you all to see this all of a sudden? Whew, there's this owl there.
Oh, everyone was just totally amazed. We didn't have your warning that you just said from before, because he was, you know, about 10 feet away from all of us. So I assume he was tired and didn't care to bother us. He just went there and looked around.
Yeah.
And then he stayed with the ship for a couple of days afterwards.
Oh, wow. Well, John, thanks for taking the photo and sharing that with us. We really appreciate that.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah.
Yeah. That ship actually in the mooring saved that bird's life. That bird was exhausted out to sea, and rather than drop into the water, it had something to land on. And I'm sure it built up its strength. As he said, it stayed with the boat a couple of days, and then it gathered itself and took off and hopefully made it back to the mainland.
Yeah. We're talking about birds, bird news with ornithologist Vernon Locks. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about birds with ornithologist Vernon Locks, 866-999-4626. If you have a bird question or a bird story you'd like to share with us, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Vern, what about this weather? Snow last week, cold temperatures this week. I imagine that's making it tough, especially on the songbirds.
Oh, it's brutal. But before we chat, one more thing on snowy owls. I can't stop talking about snowy owls. The two snowy owls that have made it to Bermuda are actually they're very well behaved. But a snowy owl showed up in Bermuda about a dozen years ago. And there's one of the rarest birds in the world called a cahow or a Bermuda petrel. That was thought to be extinct for a long time, and yet then they found a little remnant population, and they've been working really hard to bring these seabirds back, and now there's about 200 left. Well, the snowy owl that showed up there a dozen years ago landed right at the airport near there, which is where the cahow, nearby the cahows, and it started catching and eating the cahows.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and it got five of them before they finally decided to take the owl out. because and they had to shoot the two snowy owls that, so they're really worried about the owls that are there. But the owls that are there right now have moved down to this a different part of the island. They're eating other stuff. And if they go up anywhere near the cahows, they're going to trap them and deport them from Bermuda.
Oh, wow. That's funny.
Which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, it is. All right, so tell us about the weather. What's happening to our little songbirds?
Well, I got, you know, with that storm last Friday was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
That was Hercules, I guess. But that was really, I hadn't seen a, that was quite tough. And I was getting, people were calling me, what happens to the little birds in the storm? You know, do they blow out to sea? And I said, well, you know, the birds are incredibly much, they're so, they look like these tiny little fragile things, but they're really much tougher than they appear to be, thank goodness. And they have all these adaptations to deal with cold and wind and stuff like that. But they still do need to eat. And the big point I was making was just if people are feeding birds, once you start feeding birds in the fall or winter, you're, you know, the birds are used to that food source being there. And when a blizzard hits and things get covered up and frozen out, all the natural food that they had that was available for them earlier is now gone. So it's really important during times when it's snowing and really cold to go out and get out in the dawn and clean off those bird feeders, because you basically have lured them in there with free food. And now when they really need it, when they're using up their fat reserves, it's real important to stay out there and keep feeding and do so until the spring.
What about water, so, too? You know, they need water, right?
Well, water's really, yeah, water's actually even a bigger draw for a lot of the birds. But, you know, like even during that storm, I was watching a heated bird bath, and instead there was a robin that just came down to drink, but instead it went out and ate the snow.
Uh-huh.
Instead, but, mm-hmm. you know, that uses up calories because they've got to heat, they've got to melt the snow and do stuff. So birds prefer the heated water. They can drink snow, but then they're using up energy. So what happens to all the birds that spend the winter here, the chickadees, the titmice, any birds coming to your feeder, basically, downy woodpeckers, basically they go into a... well, it's the birds that migrate, it's called hyperphagia, which is a eating frenzy, and they put on lots of fat that they then burn off migrating. Our local birds try to eat like crazy too in preparation for the bad conditions that are coming during the winter, and they build up a little blubber layer, if you will. They have a subcutaneous layer of fat, and this acts not only as extra insulation, but it's also they're carrying around, if like in the blizzard last Friday they couldn't get enough calories, they start metabolizing the fat. So, but you don't, a bird doesn't want to run out of that fat by not having access to food, because they, you know, it's only two or three storms and then all the fat's gone and then they're right at the edge. So
yeah,
it's better to keep feeding.
And if you see a really big robin, it's not that he ate so much. It's more that he's putting puffing his feathers to stay warm. Is that what's like a
yeah,
down,
I mean, the
jacket?
Birds around here, they actually molt, they grow more body feathers in the fall. To give them extra insulation. I mean, birds, you know, eiderdown is like the greatest thing. Well, just think, every bird has its own down.
Mm-hmm.
Every bird, they can grow their own downy feathers. And birds, feathers grow in what's called feather tracts. And the birds have the ability to raise and lower their feathers, thereby trapping more or less air. Feathers are amazing. If you look at one under a dissecting microscope, they have these little teeth, little barbules, and they all hook together, and they're the best insulating material known. So the birds, by making more air space in between, it traps the air, also acts as an insulator. So they have a feather layer, they have their skin, a layer of down, and then they can regulate the amount of air space between several layers of feathers. And so when they're really cold, they look much bigger because they puff up.
Mm-hmm.
They extend the feathers out to trap more air, which actually keeps them warmer. And when it's really hot, you see them, and so they look much smaller because they flatten everything out so that the skin can radiate some heat out. It's quite fascinating.
It's so funny, too, when you see one of those big robins, you go, wow, that is the biggest robin I've ever seen. But yeah, when you put it in perspective.
Well, it actually is the biggest robin. You know, the colder
puffing
it gets...
out, yeah.
The bigger that robin can get. You know, it's a big, fluffy robin.
Exactly. Joel's calling from Brewster, and Joel has an owl at sea story. Morning, Joel.
Hi. When I was young, I went to school out to Ohio, and one summer I went up to Cleveland to ship out in the oar boats to make a little money over the summer. And up in Lake Superior on a cool morning, we'd sometimes get pretty heavy fogs. And us deckhands lived up forward in the forecastle, and it was about a 500-foot walk back to the galley at the after end of the ship. And we would, on these foggy mornings, along the lifeline, all the way back to the stern of the ship, there would be birds sitting on the wire, land birds that got lost in the fog. And when they came across the ship, man, they all sat right there on that wire, that lifeline going aft, until the fog lifted. Well, this one morning, walking aft, and the foghorn was going like crazy. And we got back near the funnel, and it cleared a little bit. And I looked up, and there was this owl sitting on a steel ladder that was welded to the funnel going up. And this bird had to be about 5 or 6 feet under that foghorn. It either was already deaf, or it must have been that way before long. But when the fog cleared enough that the owl could see the deck, and he sees all those birds on the rail, why, he goes right down there and cleans them all up.
Oh, dear. Was it a snowy owl?
No. It was just plain old owl, and back then I couldn't have told you one from the other. I was at sea. You don't see too many owls.
Yeah.
So that was a...
Well, see, so that owl stood there, and then all of a sudden, whoa, there's breakfast once the fog...
Right, yeah. There's a feast all the way down the length of the ship.
Oh, that's something. Joel, thanks.
That was on
thanks
one of the Great Lakes. Huh?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It was probably either a great horned or a short-eared owl or a long-eared. Anyway, that's neat.
Joel, thanks for sharing the story. Janet is calling from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I have two stories. One, that week of the storm, I went through 20 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, in about 4 days, I feed the birds, and they were just desperate.
Yeah.
I'd go out to the barn to take care of the horse, and they'd actually follow me.
Oh.
And then the other thing, sort of a sad story, I saw a downy woodpecker that didn't look well, and then I saw it hopping on the ground. I realized it couldn't fly, and I knew it was going to be stormy that night and cold, and I thought, well, I better bring it in. I don't know what else to do. So I put it in a cage, a very large cage with, you know, it was suitable, put hay in the bottom and put a bowl of water and put suet on the sides of the cage. And then some seed, which I didn't think it was going to eat, but put it in anyway. Anyway, it lived for 3 days, and I did see it drink, and I did see it eat. But the third day, I knew it was going downhill, and the next morning I saw that it was dead.
Mm.
However, the night before, I was sitting reading, and I felt things crawling on my face. I went and looked in the mirror, and there were these tiny little mites all over.
Oh, dear.
And let me tell you, I was almost panicked. I almost went down the hospital. I didn't know what to do.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, I managed to kill them all. And then the next morning when I found the poor bird dead, it was covered, really covered with these mites, which I assume is because debilitated animals cannot deal with it.
Right. Wow. What a story, Janet.
What?
Yeah, that's a tough story.
Yeah.
That's, it sounds
but
like
at least
those
poor thing died in a 50-degree room.
Oh,
But it did eat for a couple of days. I watched it, and you know, it tried to take care of itself. I saw it drink.
Yeah.
But I think it either was an older one or one that was, you know, it obviously couldn't fly.
Yeah.
And but I put my rubber gloves on and disposed of the bird. And when I looked at the rubber gloves, they were covered with brown things.
Oh my goodness.
Anyway, so it's sort of I've handled birds before, but I've never had anything get on me.
Yeah.
But obviously, I mean, there were thousands of these things.
Oh,
the
wow.
Thing.
Oh, gee. Janet, thanks for sharing that, I think.
It actually sounds like the mites are probably what killed that woodpecker.
Yeah. Oh, that's awful. Yeah.
And the good news, though, Janice, is even though they were crawling on you, the mites and lice that get on birds actually can't live on, they require the feathers, and they're specialized on birds. And even though they were crawling on you, they can't really do anything to you.
That's good to know. Good to know.
They would die, yeah.
All right. Since Janet shared a not so nice story, I'm going to share one too. I'm not feeding the birds right now, Vernon. You know, I think I figured out my problem. My feeders evidently attracted rats. So the first thing the rat
which is not unusual
said, take the feeders down immediately. Got to get rid of the food source. Luckily, it was before all the bad weather. I was feeding through the summer too, so I'm sure that had something to do with it, attracting the rats. But I'm wondering if it's I usually do separate the seed, and for some reason I did some mixed seed in almost all the feeders. So as the birds come and they don't like the seed, they're kicking it out to the ground. Where if I have like just the sunflowers, the birds, they eat the sunflowers, come and eat the sunflowers. Do you think that was my problem? Because I've had those feeders there for years and I've never had a problem with rats.
You know, rats, everywhere I've lived, I've had a rat problem.
Yeah.
But so especially when on the islands, it's particularly bad. But if you separate seeds out, right, you have a feeder that you feed millet or sunflower hearts, and just then the specialized birds come and they eat that seed. Some will drop on the ground, but not very much. And, you know, hopefully they'll clean it up. But there'll be some excess seed and there'll probably be a few rats. What I do now is you try, you know, you need to have brush piles or you need cover for the little birds. I always feel like I'm baiting them in the Cooper's hawks and the Merlins that eat small birds. If you don't have cover nearby, that's kind of like, it's the way I feel about cats outside. You know, it's just, if you have a bird feeder, you're just luring them in for the cats. So you need to take some mitigating, do something to mitigate that. Right. Well, out here, there's, even on the Cape, there's lots of things that love to eat rats. In fact, at the feeders now, there's a Cooper's hawk that we call Big Mama. And the rats over here were so bold that they, you know, rats are nocturnal. These rats were moving around the daytime. And Big Mama didn't put up with that for very long.
Wow.
And once she found out there were rats there, she was there every day or every other day taking out a big rat.
Oh, I wish I could have borrowed Big Mama.
Yeah, well, she's still around.
Yeah.
But the rats are gone. And, of course, at night, the barn owls out here come and clean them up. And the red-tailed hawks also are they know where they are. And so I actually created a couple of flight lanes where the big raptors could come in and get the mammals, the rats, basically.
Wow.
And so far this winter, there have been no rats at the feeders because I think we have natural predatory control going on.
Well, just fair warning that the rat guy said the Cape is inundated with rats right now.
Right. I mean, of course, nobody wants rats in their house.
No.
And you don't. A lot of people make the mistake of buying and storing their bird seed in a plastic plastic garbage can.
Nope.
And no, you got to use stainless or galvanized steel because
they'll eat
the
through
rats
it.
Can't
yeah.
chew through
and,
that.
And
otherwise,
the mice
they
do too.
Smell it.
Yeah. And the mice will chew through it too.
Everything will come for it.
Yeah. The other thing too, the rats will go to your compost pile. So that's another thing you got to be careful. Wherever there's a food source, they say that you'll find the rats. But when you're talking about the brush, that's a really good point because as you know, near my bird feeders, I have a forsythia hedge. And the year we cut it down, there were hardly any birds. But when we have that forsythia hedge, you know, because they duck in and out of that.
Right. They would hide. Give them shelter from predators, shelter from the elements, everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And I told Amy was asking the same thing yesterday. She said, I feel like I'm luring in the poor little birds to their death because she's got a Cooper's hawk that's kind of milling about. So basically it's give them some kind of protection and that should.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I don't, you know, it's hard. Cooper's hawks, sharp-shinned hawks, Merlins, and most of the, you know, as I've said about the snowy owls, it's really hard being a raptor. Imagine having to capture and eat these small, fast land birds. And most of the young hawks, half of them won't make it through their first winter. So like when I see a Cooper's hawk, if it gets a mourning dove or something, well, you know what? They're only going to eat one mourning dove every couple of days, and there aren't very many Cooper's hawks, and there's lots and lots of mourning doves. It's the way nature is. It's, you know, it's tooth and nail out there. It's a jungle.
All right. We're not rat experts here, but I got a couple of questions. How about a dog to control rats? A rat terrier? A ferret? I have a dog. It didn't do anything for the rat.
Right. And I'm aware that people keep ferrets as pets, and I would imagine.
But I don't think they eat rats. But I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I think they.
All right, 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with ornithologist Vernon Locks, 866-999-4626 for your bird questions or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Vern, last weekend I was on the vineyard looking for snowy owls, which I didn't see, but I did see this beautiful great blue heron that just looked as perky, and it was. And I'm worried about him now because with this weather. So these birds that normally head south, it's a real gamble if they stick around, right?
Well, if you're a great blue heron, it certainly is it's a roll of the dice, because birds lose their body heat. They lose heat through their soft parts, and the soft parts on a bird are their beak, their legs, their feet, and there's a ring of skin around the eye called an orbital ring. And if you now to look at the body type, like think about a snowy owl, where it's got nothing exposed. Its beak is even, there's feathers. You can't even see its beak. Its legs are fully feathered. Its feet are feathered. Even its talons just sort of stick out through all the feathering. So they're incredibly insulated. They don't lose any heat. And then you look at a heron, a great blue heron. It's got a bill that's 5 or 6 inches long, which is just a big, it's like a radiator radiating heat out. It's got these enormously long legs and feet. And yeah, if it stays cold for very long, the great blue herons, you know, they don't make it. Mm. They can't eat enough food. Of course, when it gets really cold and then things ice up, then the access to their food is gone as well. But so far, I mean, this morning I went on a little bike ride and I saw 3 great blue herons flying by, and they look fine.
Good.
So they're getting enough to eat, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's been such a weird winter, even though it gets really nasty and cold. And then it seems like 2 days later, it's 50 degrees and everything's breaking up again. So that's if it really freezes hard and stays that way, then the herons really are going to wish they flew south.
Yeah.
The good news for the species is, you know, there's a number of trade-offs with migration. You know, if you're a great blue heron that nests, say you nest in central Massachusetts or you nest in Maine, and then you fly down to Florida or the Gulf Coast for the winter, that's great, but you know, you've got to fly 1,500 miles over all sorts of obstacles and find food on the way and not run into wires or get attacked by a golden eagle. And then you've got to find a place to winter, and then you've got to migrate back. So there's look at all the energy required for that. Whereas if you just come out to the coastline, some of the marshes, there's plenty of food. And you know, the gamble there is that you don't get a long, hard freeze for a while. Anyway, most of the population does migrate south. So even if the ones that are here don't have a good winter and don't make it, they will be in the spring. Their population will recover nicely. So it's just nature, the way nature works.
The way it is. All right. Mary's giving us a call from Bass River. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Good morning. I'm an amateur birder, and I always feed the birds, and I listen to you, and I really love you, Vernon. It's really fun to hear you, and I learned a lot from you. One thing is, we did see a snowy owl on West Dennis Beach within the last week.
Mm. Nice.
He was just sitting there in the dunes, and the camouflage was absolutely fabulous, and it was great. We stayed right in the car, and we didn't disturb him. We opened our windows and took out our binocs, but we didn't want to make him fly, and I found it very interesting that he's now eating sea ducks.
Yeah.
Right. I didn't know that. Now, the other comment I have is, the other day, a flock of robins have come in. There got to be between 30 and 50 of them. I'm trying to figure them out, but I can't. And I put out water, and I put out warm water every morning, and they flock in 5 at a time. They come drink, and I just keep replacing it all day long because it's so cold. Now, is this normal?
Oh, yes. Robins, thrushes, robins love water. Eastern bluebirds love water. I've seen them flying over at great altitude, and especially when it's really cold, and they can see a bird bath because I think it's steaming.
Right.
And they'll drop right out of the sky, come down. First, they drink lustily. Your robins probably bathed as well, didn't they?
Well, you know what they didn't. The sparrows did. I was watching to see that. It's a perfect bathing bowl for sparrows. I've seen 5 sparrows in it at once, which is very cute, very darling picture. But I haven't seen the robins get in. And I keep every 2 or 3 hours, I go and replace it with warm water, you know, so that they have a continual thing. And I think we have holly trees. Are they eating those berries?
That's probably the American hollies?
Yes.
Yeah, that's like their favorite food.
Jeez, so. Mary, you got the food form there. You're coming out every couple hours. You're great.
And by the way, I do have 2 bird feeders, and we have the perfect location. We have brush right there. And we get everything. I've got a suet feeder, a finch, the thistle feeder, and the birdseed feeder, and I constantly mix different things in it. So we've got the flicker comes to the suet because it's so cold he can't find anything to eat.
Mm-hmm. And wow, I'm coming to your house.
You know, I was thinking
and
the so, same thing.
And then we've got the red-bellied woodpecker, the hairy woodpecker, and the downy woodpecker.
Wow, sounds great.
Really, I throw raisins out. Do the robins eat them?
Robins love to eat them. Catbirds, of course, you probably don't have any catbirds right now.
We don't.
Actually, a lot of robins eat them. They love raisins.
Yeah. Okay, good. So I'll just continue throwing them out for them a bit.
Yeah, wow. Okay. Mary, thanks for that.
Great. Love to hear you. I hope you stay on the air. I learned so much from you.
Great.
Thanks so much.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
So much.
Thank you.
All right, so I wanted to ask you about the long-tailed ducks. What's going on? There aren't as many as we usually see. This is what, cut last couple of years?
Yeah, it's kind of a mystery what's happened. I've asked Edith and Ginger Andrews about it, and apparently, historically, there are periods of a few years when they stop doing their thing. And what their thing that we're talking about is most years, or they haven't done this for the last 2 years, though, a tremendous number, the largest number of long-tailed ducks, they used to call them old squaw, these really fast-flying black and white sea ducks that, I mean, literally they fly at 60 and 70 miles an hour. And they spend the night in Nantucket Sound, between Nantucket and Hyannis, basically. And then every morning before dawn, they get up in these huge numbers. I mean, there's so many, it looks like clouds of birds, it looks like smoke coming. And they come roaring by the west end of the island, and they calling too. Like, they make it sounds like a flock of it's incredible, and you can hear the wind in their wings, and they go whoosh, they go blowing by, and they go anywhere from 30 to 50 miles south of Nantucket to feed on these little euphausid shrimp, these little krill like things that apparently the right whales used to eat. And then since Nantucket was famous for its whaling, we depleted the whale numbers, so there's really all this excess food out there, and apparently the long-tailed ducks figured out how to take advantage of food that the whales are not there to eat. Anyway, and you would think these are the only ducks that we know of that they fly like 100 miles a day to go to a food source and fly back. I mean, you would think that energy expenditure would not be worth it, but clearly it was to them because they were doing it for many, many years. And then something has changed in the last couple of years. There's still long-tailed ducks around, but you know we only see 500 or 1,000, nothing like the 600,000 or half a million ducks that we used to figure which would come by. And you know the jury's still out. We'll see what happens. We'll just keep watching. But that phenomena, which was one of the most exciting spectacles I've ever seen in the bird world,
me too.
Anywhere in the world, is no longer happening.
It
and
is
I can't
amazing
wait for it to start again.
I would say it's amazing. You took me out a few years ago to see that, and it's you can't even describe it. It's mind-boggling. It
yeah,
is. It's
I mean,
like
it's,
smoke
it's
in the sky.
It's jaw-dropping.
It's unbelievable.
And you're just like, wow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, hopefully they'll come back. Are they doing? Do we know? Are they doing it somewhere else? I mean, where are they?
It's not happening anywhere else. And this doesn't happen anywhere else in the world either.
Wow.
But one thing about long-tailed ducks, I've read accounts of them returning to their Arctic breeding grounds from some of the Inuit villages up north. And apparently, you know, it's snow-covered and cold, and it's April, late April, early May, and there's no ducks. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, the long-tailed ducks arrive in a huge flock of 50,000 birds. So they stay together. They do everything synchronously.
Wow.
But even spending the winter here, which I think probably has everything to do with them breeding. Because the Arctic, some years they can't even nest because there's too much snow and stuff. So when they stick together in a flock, I think it's got a lot to do with them reproducing. And so when they get to a breeding area like that, they're all excited. They're up and breeding very quickly. So I think they just stay in. I think they stay in packs, you know.
I have a question for you. It says, I saw a catbird the other day. Is that abnormal?
No. There are. It used to be that catbirds weren't known to winter, but there are. Every bird count gets them. There's actually hundreds of gray catbirds that overwinter on the Cape and Islands, but they change their behavior completely from spring to fall. In the winter, it's all about surviving. So they stay in heavy cover. They don't make any noise, although they still call usually once or twice at dawn and dusk, certain light levels. Their favorite food in the winter here is the little berries on the greenbrier, the thickets. Okay. You know, the little greenbrier, yep. the prickers there, yep. the little yep. vine. That's their favorite. So areas with lots of greenbrier, that's they also eat red cedars, hollies and stuff. Yep. But there are a lot more catbirds around than you'd ever know about because they stay really yeah. tucked in. They don't want to get eaten by hawks either.
All right, tell us about the gull show.
The gull show is the southeast corner of Nantucket is just geographically perfectly situated for ocean currents, and there's an amazing concentration of birds that always occur out here each winter, starting about Thanksgiving, and then it starts to sort of break up by the middle of February. There's nothing like it on the eastern seaboard. Right now there's like 4,000 or 5,000 of these little tern-like gulls called Bonaparte's gulls. And usually in with the Bonaparte's gulls are a couple of European species called the little gull, which I love. Its Latin name is Larus minutus. it's the smallest gull in the world. Very rare in North America. And like there's been three little gulls out there, and then this European gull called black-headed gull. And then there's some larger gulls. Herring gull is the familiar gull on the Cape and Islands, and great blackback gull. And they're what we call four-year gulls. So from the time they hatch in late May, early June, it takes them 4 years. They molt each year. They grow new body feathers twice a year and new wing and tail feathers once a year. And we understand the sequence of molts so we can tell how old they are, like a first cycle, until they're 4.5 years old. Once they're an adult, you can't tell how old they are anymore. And then there's lesser blackback gulls, a European species that is more common out there on the southeast corner of Nantucket than anywhere else in the entire country. They get concentrations, and it's amazing. So there's a gull from the far north called the Iceland gull, which is all white wingtips. We get lots of adults. Gulls are very long-lived. Once they make it to the breeding age, if they survive to then, they can live to be, 30, 40 years old. The oldest herring gull we know about is 36 years old in the wild. And in captivity, they had one that lived to be 65 in a zoo. So anyway, the gulls, once they find a place like the gull show on the southeast corner of Nantucket, they'll come back every year. I think a lot of the same birds are back year after year. And it's a fantastic, if you're interested in gulls and birds, you probably owe yourself a trip out to Sconset and Low Beach on Nantucket.
All right, Nancy just sent us an email. I can attest to the importance of water to the birds. We feed the birds all winter, but we also have a heated bird bath, and it's a big hit of the property. A few weeks ago, we saw 10 bluebirds ringed around it or waiting their turns. Might have been even more. It was really spectacular. We haven't had as many all at once since then, but usually two or three are around most of the time. And we hadn't seen any bluebirds at all this winter until they all appeared on the heated bird bath. What a thrill that was. I can imagine.
Where does she live?
She lives in Wellfleet. And then nice. Jean in East Falmouth says she had to take down her beloved bird feeders due to rats. I have a neighbor with chickens and other fowl who has not rat-proofed his enclosure, so there are lots of food around for the rats. Wow, she said 24 rats. Yikes. So it says this is a plea to food-proof your so we don't get the rats. Molly is listening. She wants to know about owl behavior that could signal to people that they're getting too close to the birds. So how do you know you're getting too close? Real quick, we got 15 seconds for him.
Oh, if the bird changes its paw, they turn their heads around. They look at you. If it moves at all, a lot of times snowy owls are hunkered down. If it puts its head up, it stretches its neck out. If it does anything that's different, you're too close. You're disturbing it.
And just real quick, people have been asking about our Saturday Bird News program. We had funding for 10 episodes, so we're working on it, but we'll see what happens. All right, Vernon Lux, joining us from the Lindy Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. Thanks, Vern.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.